Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. My name is Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. How's it going out there, all my Bitcoiners all around the world? Thank you for joining me again today here at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. Today, a special episode, a milestone. This is the 100th episode of this podcast. I'm excited to do something a little different, kind of reflect on my personal journey learning Bitcoin, and that's, you know, really what I started this podcast to do, you know, share my journey learning Bitcoin and hoping it makes yours a bit easier. So that's what we're going to do in this episode. But before we dive in, a quick check-in with Swan. Really exciting developments on the Swan front. We have pushed out improved KYC flow. We are approving most accounts same day now, which is awesome. And we are about to push out daily buys. We're going to do a beta for that. SwanBitcoin.com/daily buys. Get in that group. You can be one of the first set of people to be stacking daily on Swan. We have close to 1,000 people signed up. We're going to cap it there. So get over to SwanBitcoin.com/daily buys to get into that group. Gigi has joined the team, and his first project was to roll out XPubs, which allows us to create a bunch of addresses for you, and then you can, we'll change the address every time you automatically withdraw. The vast majority of our customers are auto withdrawing, which is exactly what we were hoping for. Right now, it's kind of, you know, you have to go in and manually add another address. This way, we'll be able to automatically change the address for every single withdrawal. That's awesome. I know a lot of you will very much appreciate that. It is a Bitcoin best practice for privacy reasons. So Gigi will be rolling that out soon. And next up on the list, by popular demand, one-time buys. Yes, you'll be able to go into your Swan dashboard and add a little something extra on top of your regular Swan plan purchases. So that's going to be awesome. Lots of cool stuff coming up for Swan. If you're not stacking with Swan yet, you can go to swanbitcoin.com/Brady. We'll drop 10 bucks of Bitcoin into your account when you start stacking. And if you are already stacking with Swan, deep appreciation to you. Your early support of the company and service is huge. We really appreciate it. All right, let's dive into this one. Episode 100, bit of a milestone. The premise of this pod from the beginning was to document my journey learning Bitcoin. And yes, I have hope that it might help you on yours as well, but it's also been hugely helpful to me to make this podcast, and not to mention it's been a freaking blast. So in this one, I went back into the early interview episodes and grabbed some clips of me sharing about the early days of my journey when I lacked any conviction at all about what was going on here, up to recent episodes where I'm bullish as fuck and utterly convicted that we're all living through the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance right now. In between are clips that represent the ideas that I have gleaned from the great Bitcoiners I've had the opportunity to interview and discuss Bitcoin with over the past couple of years, and have become the foundational ideas of my understanding of Bitcoin. Thank you for listening and for your support of the podcast. I talk a lot about how Bitcoin changes us as individuals, but the change I've appreciated most are the great friends I've made along the way. It's been awesome to get to know a lot of you and to fight alongside you on the Bitcoin Twitter battlefield. Thank you to all the previous guests out there who might be listening. We've all learned a lot from you, and we really appreciate your dedication to spreading Bitcoin knowledge. And a special shout out to Tommy, my friend Tommy, who I started this podcast with back in 2017. We just wanted to record and put out our, you know, conversations about Bitcoin, and thought that it would help us learn. So it was a lot of fun getting this thing started, and it turned into what it turned into. So thanks for that, Tommy. Appreciate you, man. This was a useful exercise for me. I hope it's useful to you. And in any case, thanks for indulging me on this one. And next week, we'll be back to talking with more great Bitcoiners for the next 100 episodes. Here we go. Oh man, I mean, I did that with the forks. I did that. I held Ethereum for quite a while. You know, I was like, what if I'm wrong? What if proof of stake is right? You know, and when you're at first, there's just so much to learn. It takes a while to develop that conviction, and so I think it makes sense, like for your own, like, sanity, to, you know, maybe pick
you know, the three or five that you think have the best chance instead of just committing to one right at first. And it, you know, it helped me. My conviction is much stronger now, you know, but
which three or five do you choose?
Well, I held Bitcoin Cash and I held Ethereum, for quite a while. Those are the only two that I really held.
It was like the Coinbase Mafia. You just held the Coinbase Mafia, basically.
Yeah, I just wasn't like I wrote a blog post about why Roger was wrong about scaling and everything. I was pretty sure, but I kept having these like late night, like laying in bed, like self doubt sessions.
What if I'm wrong?
Yeah, what if I'm wrong? You know, like be humble, dude. Like, you know, you could be wrong. There's a lot to learn here. There's a lot to know. Yeah, and it's just, you know, I think that there's some people are more self-doubtful than others, I guess, just in general. And I think I'm probably like kind of in the middle of the road as far as that goes. But yeah, I was like, you know, what is it when I sold all my Bitcoin Cash, like around that time, like that weekend, basically
before or after the Ninja launch,
the Thanksgiving weekend. No, like I sold it that night.
It was going up.
Yeah, like $4,200.
Damn, dude. Good for you. Yeah,
well, I stayed up all night and I was like, I'm going to watch this and go. And I just, you know, I was in a good group of people. They were just like, oh man, this red candle is going to be amazing when it hits, you know? And
that's my favorite part.
Yeah. So I got a pretty good deal on that. But then when it got like just dropped down super low during the bear market, I was like, look, I can scoop up, you know? And so for like 3 months during this bear market, I was like, I was holding on to some Ethereum, some Bitcoin Cash, and then it kind of came to my senses. I was like, come on, man. Like, you're right. Just, you know, dump the shit. Let's move on. So yeah, I did that. I mean, I admit to it. It happened, but it was a result of, you know, like a few nights in a row of just being like, all right, what if you're wrong? Look how cheap it is to like cover your ass just in case you're wrong, you know?
Yeah. So anyway. No, I respect that.
Because I came in early 2017. So I kind of had it, you know, I saw it, I think maybe 2015 for the first time. And I made a Coinbase account and had trouble transferring money from my like kind of smaller regional bank into Coinbase and gave up. And then just sort of had it on my radar and was like, if it ever goes over the previous all time high, then I'm going to take a closer look at it. Because it'll, you know, that'll signal to me that it's, you know, it's not dead and it'll be interesting to check out. And so that when that happened in 2017, I was following a couple of Bitcoin Twitter accounts and there was this kind of new price run happening. And I started taking a look at it. It was, you know, I went down the Andreas Antonopoulos, you know, kind of YouTube rabbit hole and started reading all the books and the blog posts and getting into the debates and going back and looking at the history and the forums and all that. And then, you know, the block debate, the block size debate kind of came up. And I got really confused because I didn't know enough about Bitcoin yet. And so I was susceptible to a lot of the FUD that was coming from the Bitcoin Cash side.
Yeah.
And so can Bitcoin scale this way? What is the right way? You know, and I didn't understand how to evaluate the debate. I didn't have the information to do it. And it was hard to get, like, I remember asking questions of people. I was like trying to identify, like, who can I trust, right, on either side so I can try to evaluate this debate. And I remember like tweeting at people like Pierre Rochard, asking some questions about like Blockstream or something, you know, and he would right back and be like, I can't tell if you're trolling me or not, you know, like what's going on? You know, it was just so hard to like talk about it as a noob because no one knew who you were. You didn't have that sort of like history, on Twitter and to allow people to trust you or whatever. And so eventually I worked it out. I wrote my way of kind of figuring it out was to write a blog post, about my decision, you know, and published it as kind of part right around the time we started this podcast. The first few episodes are us really kind of going through how we evaluated the block size debate, me and my friend Tommy, who co-hosts the show. And man, I went off on Roger for a couple of months on Twitter, because he was at that point where he was just repeating these bald-faced lies about, you know, Bitcoin Cash being Bitcoin and, you know, changing or like basically duping people who were trying to buy Bitcoin on Bitcoin.com into buying Bitcoin Cash and just causing all this confusion. So yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I was angry at this guy. Like, I try not to let, for the most part, like I just kind of like, I'm pretty chill on Twitter, you know, I'm pretty like neutral. And, but man, Roger just pushed all the buttons for me. Yeah, I get it. I get it. Like he just, I don't know. The world is thirsty for some ethical leadership, especially in the realm of money. Because boy, it's been pretty unethical for a while. The process of money production and empowering and enabling a lot of pretty terrible things that I think the world as in general doesn't really ascribe to the production of money. Like that, you know, I never made that connection, the connection between, you know, Keynesianism and the power of the state to control the money supply and just run away militarism, I guess, over the past century. That's been made possible by the ability of the state to print money to pay for all that stuff. Money is the root of all evil. Maybe like that's even not specific enough, I guess. The ability of a central party or a small number of people in a society to print money, that power is the root of all evil. The separation of money and state. And I think that meme is going to be a very successful one for Bitcoin, especially in the United States, where the idea of the separation of church and state is so powerful and is still taught as being a fundamental ethic of our Constitution and of one of the reasons that we have, you know, a more free society than we used to have. And so I think making the analogy between the separation of church and state and the separation of money and state will really kind of be a key to open people's minds, especially in liberal democracies, who will understand that idea. So I think we'll be hearing a lot about that over the next decade or two. And it's going to be a big battle to reboot our cultural and social operating system, economic operating system. Yeah, so the Keynesian prescription, you know, in theory was that governments could, you know, print some money to help smooth out a crisis. Then they would, you know, take that money out of the market when things were in better shape. But in practice, that's just not the way things work out. So now we're in this situation where, you know, we've been in this, you know, we've built this default Keynesian world where everyone's just, you know, all the government central bankers around the world and anybody who's, you know, basically most economists subscribe or, you know, ascribe to this idea. And now it's evolved into, because I think, you know, bankers and economists have realized that the counter prescription to the printing of money to smooth out that that downturn doesn't work, right? So the only option then is just to continue printing more money. So now we have this, is that basically what the idea of modern monetary theory that they get into is like, hey, we're in this, we figured out that, you know, the way that this ends up playing out in practice is that we just have to keep printing money and that's what we're going to do forever. Yeah. And the idea that, and when I first came in, I definitely saw some older Bitcoiners, longtime Bitcoiners, be pretty like rude, I guess, you know, or really abrupt or like having a major lack of patience for people asking new questions, you know, noobs asking questions. And there were lots of noobs coming in 2017 as the price was going up, and that's going to happen again at some point. And there's just so much going on. You're trying to find some signal and like ask people questions, ask questions from the people who you think are sending out some, you know, trustworthy and quality thinking and signal. It pushed, you know, kind of like repelled me a little bit too. I was like, that's, you know, that's not great. that gives me kind of this bad feeling. It should be more understanding and patient inclusive. A couple of years later, you know, there's this, actually I just tweeted about this not too long ago. Let's see if I can find it. Yeah. So Vijay Boyapati, who wrote The Bullish Case for Bitcoin, I think, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Big fan.
Yeah. Big fan. Has a solid understanding of Bitcoin, has put a lot of time into understanding it. And, you know, there's a Ripple XRP person that pops into some thread and says like, you know, Ripple costs a penny, Ripple transactions cost a penny and takes 3 seconds comparing to, you know, Bitcoin's 1 to 3 hours or whatever. And he just goes, goodbye, shitcoiner, blocked, gone, right? And so I wrote like, you know, I saw that and I was just like, yeah, that's what you do. To a noob, like kind of lacking that critical information and context, and you're kind of susceptible to the FUD, you don't have that conviction yet, that can come off as extreme, as an overreaction, or as toxic. But after you've been around for a while, you've done your reading, you've done your listening, you've done your learning, you get this as sort of a, look, I am past this point and I just can't spare the time anymore to have this conversation over and over again. It's on the web. Go, you know, read about it and figure it out, but I can't handle this anymore. And even Satoshi, you know, if you don't understand it, I don't have time to explain it to you, you know? And so it's that idea that there is information out there, enough information out there for you to arrive at a better understanding than Ripple is the new Bitcoin. And I just don't have time anymore to devote to teaching someone that's at your stage of understanding, because there's so much at stake here and there's a lot to do. Yeah. And that's a phrase I've used a lot before, is that Bitcoin's gravity is strong and, you know, it'll just slowly kind of suck you into its orbit until you just, you know, are crossing the event horizon into the black hole of Bitcoin. And it's done that to me as well. And I think, you know, as like that's kind of like the spores that live, right? The spores that sort of get captured by Bitcoin's gravity and then nourished into new colonies. It's insanely strong. And it's because it's so fascinating and because it has so much potential. And, you know, not just the, like we've said several times in this discussion so far, not just the financial potential for us as individuals, but the potential for society, and to really just kind of fundamentally fix a lot of the problems that have resulted from, you know, centralizing, too much centralization, I guess, in the organization of society. And I'm not going to, you know, be this decentralist utopian and say like it's going to fix all of our problems or anything. Humans are humans, and we're going to have problems. But I think that the pendulum has swung too far toward, you know, centralization of power, and we need to have another, you know, disruption of that centralized power. And we've had examples of that in, you know, political history. The one I'm most familiar with is the U.S. Revolution, which resulted in a more decentralized governance system than the one that, you know, the English colonists were rebelling against. And I think Bitcoin can have a similar effect. I think, you know, in the future, we'll have a more decentralized form of government because of the, you know, the incentives that Bitcoin is establishing. That's the changes. And this is a great transition into the next and I guess last topic that I want to talk to you about. And that's the idea about of learning about Bitcoin. And, you know, I've observed that, you know, with every wave, and we've talked about this with the spore analogy, every wave, there's this, you know, massive increase in attention to Bitcoin until it's, you know, for a couple of months, sort of just, you know, everywhere. It's, I think this past cycle, you know, it reached obviously a new peak of just, it was everywhere, in the mainstream media, and people were talking about everywhere. Everyone, all the Bitcoiners are getting texts like, hey, you know something about Bitcoin, right? I heard you mention Bitcoin before. Tell me about it. Where do I buy it? What's going on? What's Ripple? What's Bcash? What's, you know, all this stuff. You get all these questions, this massive amounts of attention. And from that massive amount of attention, we've got these new waves of content creators and educators that come through every cycle and build during the bear market and then prepare to sort of deliver these new messages that we've all sort of synthesized and derived from our learning over the past, you know, couple of years. And like, it's, I think the experience for noobs in this next cycle is going to be even better. It will still be very noisy and very confusing, and there'll be a lot of challenges to learning Bitcoin and coming away with a clear understanding. But I think this kind of foundation of what is the beginnings of a Bitcoin education industry, which I think will be massive over the next couple of decades as people realize, you know, the gravity of this thing that is being built and growing, you know, all the time before us, is, you know, irresistible. So basically, there'll be this sort of point where a mass audience, kind of the vertical part of the technological, you know, S curve, the adoption S curve, people are just like, oh, okay, I need to understand this. I've got to understand this right now. Like, it's, I can see this is the next thing, and there's this big change coming, and I need to figure out what's going on. That's going to be, there's going to be massive demand for reliable, clear Bitcoin education at some point in the coming decades. And I think that's kind of the beginnings of that is really building now. You know, I was tempted. Well, before we go to second lesson, actually, I was tempted to go down a little rabbit hole already on this first one, because I've been doing a lot of thinking about the social this idea of a social layer and like the code, the technical or code layer of Bitcoin. And it was definitely, you know, spurred by Hasu's article that you cite, and also by Brandon's article that Bitcoin is a social organism. And I think I've, after several kind of back and forths on Twitter with many different Bitcoiners, and on Discord and just talking about it in general with people, I think I've come to the conclusion that I feel like the word social is a little problematic for some people, because I don't think it's precise enough. I think that Bitcoin is an economic contract, but you know, economics is also a social creature, right? It's like a particular kind of a social creature. But I do think that the precision here is important, because there's a lot of context. Like, the idea, the phrase social contract is really, it comes from, it has its origins in political philosophy and political thought. And so the idea of a social contract to me implies a lot more politics and like social, mm-hmm. like a lot more political kind of interaction than does economic interaction. I can also see, like, yeah, well, you know, all the debates about like consensus algorithm and how, you know, the Bitcoin core code and all of that are political debates in essence, right? Because there's lots of politics that go involved to convincing each other about how Bitcoin should be. I think that the other way to look at it, though, is that what Bitcoin is actually an economic shelling point of individuals in a free market arriving at a shelling point about what the best money is to use for that free market, right? And that, so fundamentally the process that's driving that agreement is the qualities of sound money, and not the qualities of a particular person's debate skills or persuasive skills, et cetera. You know, that quote by Saifedean, only two things are genuinely scarce, time and Bitcoin. That idea is really, really important, in terms of the, you know, the consequences or ramifications of what Bitcoin will do for us as people and as individuals and as a society. And Masir Mohammadov gets into this on an episode of Tales from the Crypt, where...
Yeah, it's an awesome episode.
Yeah, and it's really important. And it's something I've been using a lot lately with people who are, you know, new to Bitcoin and asking me about it. But the only thing in the world that's really genuinely scarce besides Bitcoin is time. And we've been trading our time, our effort, and our work for a money that is absolutely not scarce and is easily made. More of it is easily made, and so it's just a really fundamentally bad deal for people to trade your time and effort for something which is extremely scarce, for something that is absolutely not scarce at all. And it's probably already the case that gold is not the best way to store your wealth.
Yeah, I think
depending on your time preference, right? Like if you're thinking at least like a decade or more into the future in terms of storing your wealth at this point in time, Bitcoin makes a lot more sense to gold than gold to me. And, you know, if Bitcoin hasn't eaten up gold's market cap by 2024, then there's literally no argument left, you know, because it's actually harder money at that point. Right, exactly. Well, let's talk about the incentive there. Let's follow it, because it's, you know, it's something that most people haven't done or haven't thought about, and it's an important thought exercise. When I realized the how closely the incentives of governments are with Keynesian thought, it made perfect sense. Basically, Keynesianism is giving conceit or giving credence to that conceit that we can control money better than some naturally occurring money or some market chosen money like gold has been throughout history, right? So the idea is, look, we've discovered economics and we understand this, how this stuff works now. And so we can actually control the money to prevent the, you know, normal business cycles from really wreaking havoc on our economy. We can sort of tame. So let's give an example here. 2008, we have a economic collapse, a financial crisis. And we understand pretty well how it happened. Subprime mortgages, too much, you know, a credit bubble, all this stuff. There was systemic risk and it builds up into bubbles and, you know, they pop. And the response Keynesianism prescribes is government needs to spend money now because consumers are pulling back from spending, right? And if we allow that to happen, this collapse in spending will destroy the economy and it'll be far last far longer and be far worse than if we just intervene now in various ways. And so in 2009, 2010, and the subsequent years, we intervened in many ways, including decreasing, you know, cutting, slashing interest rates. And we have negative interest rates in the European Central Bank, many countries in Europe. Japan has negative interest rates now. And we also, of course, printed a lot of money. We called it quantitative easing, which is another example of those kind of wordy ways that Keynesians sort of confuse the situation.
Yeah, it's a euphemism for printing money.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And there are long, long wordy articles out there that try to, you know, convince us that it's not printing money. There's literally several articles titled "Quantitative Easing is Not the Same as Printing Money." And they make an attempt in a very Keynesian way, you know, just this very academic way, very wordy, 6,000, 7,000 word articles trying to prove this point, but it's just not true. That's the Keynesian prescription. You know, they use this kind of idea, this fear that if we don't do this, it's going to be way worse, right? And the politics of fear is very powerful. It's used in every aspect of our political world. Decentralization is the key to immutability, right? To the fact that we can't inflate the supply, and the fact that we can't change the protocol, right? Which I think is also important, right? But yeah, so that's basically what it is. Is it comes down to the fact that we have a decentralized protocol that is being checked by, you know, what, 100,000 plus nodes all around the world, and just like BitTorrent, which was this P2P network, was sort of the final piece of the puzzle, right, for Bitcoin to be invented. There were several attempts at creating money for the internet, native digital money, but couldn't get around the Byzantine generals problem, the double spend problem, without a central server, a central authority. And we saw Napster get taken down because it used central servers to distribute these files, and then Bram Cohen introduces BitTorrent, which is a decentralized version of Napster, which couldn't be co-opted, right? And so that was the kind of final piece of the puzzle. And I think BitTorrent was launched like 2002, 2003. 5 years later, Satoshi has kind of worked out how to use this BitTorrent-like peer-to-peer network to solve the problem of the central authority in solving the double spend problem. But that also created was the answer to creating a money that was inflation resistant and with a monetary policy that was unchangeable, because there's literally no central authority, which is the monetary system that we've been living under for a long time. And the reason gold failed and the reason we've seen debased currencies over and over again throughout human history is that some central authority takes control of the money supply and debases it because it's irresistible, as we talked about. Yeah, and it comes down to just really one simple truth, you know, the truth of hard money, the way money is, you know, supposed to function in a society as we had discovered it thousands of years ago to, you know, solve the problems of barter, the coincidence of wants. And it's really a simple thing. It's a really simple thing, but it's a very powerful discovery, really. And now we've, you know, and speaking of cults based on lies, you know, I call these people Keynesian cultists, and, you know, they've been spreading falsehoods of central banking and quantitative easing and negative interest rates, monetary central planning and all that stuff. They've created generations of default Keynesians. It's just like people walk around and it's just the way things are now, and people just accept it. And they default to this kind of idea. But, you know, now we have Bitcoin. Bitcoin's waking people up and teaching them what money really is. And I think having that real world example is critical to really, you know, like I said, waking people up. You can kind of talk about this stuff until you're blue in the face, but, you know, the Austrian economists and some of the libertarians have tried that, you know, to no avail for decades and decades now. So I think we have this, you know, this real world instantiation of hard money is going to make a big difference in waking people up. This is where hodlers earn their stripes and like earn the rewards, all right? Because you're down to 150. There's plenty of people that said, fuck this. Fuck it. They rage quit. They capitulate.
We had the bear whale.
They're done. They're just done. But then the other way, you know, what hodlers do is you just steal your reserve and you're like, all right, I'm going to figure this thing out. I'm going to understand what has lost me all this money on paper and learn it and study it and talk about it with other Bitcoiners and seek education and wisdom, right? In those moments where you're just getting absolutely just demolished and just you're all the pain, you know, the psychological suffering that you're feeling. And that's where hodlers really earn it, man. That's where they earn these gains. All the early guys like that are still around, that was a lot of pain you go through, a lot of fear. And like, you know, if you got the stomach to handle that, then, you know, cheers to you. It's a fascinating time for it to happen too, because we're sort of at this precipice, right, of, you know, massive human change one way or another, because of the technology we've developed, right? And so what direction are we going to go? This change has, you know, piled up on each other, these sort of like exponential evolutions, and we're, you know, that time is compressing, and these kind of doublings of technological power are just happening so fast now. The network effects are piling up on each other. When do we merge with machine? How do we merge with machine? There's something that's going to happen, and you just kind of can feel this crescendo, you know, that we're this crest of this wave that we're surfing right now as a species, as a planet, and it's which way do we go? And like Bitcoin comes along at this time where it could really influence which path we take, right? If we continue on this sort of short-term thinking, chasing the quarterly earnings, you know, keeping up with the Joneses, you end up with somewhere that's like, you know, we're all sitting in some like floating pod, you know, 300 pounds watching some AR, you know, representation of like beautiful nature when everything's gone to shit completely around us, that dystopic future. Or we have this like, you know, nudged this other path by Bitcoin where we're thinking longer term, we're like re-engaging with those sort of natural tendencies that we had in lots of human societies in the past, the seven generation thinking, right? This long-term thinking that really moves us toward creating the kind of planet that Brandon was talking about, this kind of Eden, right? Which really requires this kind of symbiotic long-term thinking. I was just going to say, I think that that's going to be, I mean, that's the way I see this all playing out, right? Is this sort of de-evolution of this central state, the central authority, and organizing society from the top down, a return to the idea that, you know, this country that America was founded upon, which is sort of this weaker central federal government and, you know, local governance in the forms of states, municipalities, counties, etc. I see that dissolving back into a more decentralized system. And I think it's going to center around these, centers of energy production, right? And I think what will develop around those is like small sort of, I don't know, you can call them city states or, provinces, whatever, just some kind of like, sovereign municipality, self-governing entity. And you can enter in and out of that as a relationship with Bitcoin, right? So like you can, as you enter into that particular district, you can like put X amount of Bitcoin on the blockchain, commit it in a multi-sig address to like, in conjunction with whatever governance body is in that district. And then you live there, that's sort of your buy-in. That's your skin in the game into that place. And you're basically saying, I agree to abide by the, published laws of this district, as long as I'm here and behave by these rules. Then when you're ready to exit that district and move on to somewhere else, you just take that Bitcoin, you go to the next place, you kind of buy into that next district, and you get to move around and sort of shop around for the type of political environment you want to be in, right? The type of society you want to be in. I think at the center of each of those is going to be, this whatever mode of energy production is, best suited to that particular area. And it's going to kind of build out around that. That's going to be kind of the mining locus, the energy locus. And then you'll have these districts of political experimentation that you kind of duck in and duck out of as you wish.
Yeah. And I mean, we're only 10 years in here. And we're already seeing the evidence that the idea that was given to us in the white paper and then formalized in operational code on January 3rd, 2009 has grown in 10 and a half years to this global religious movement, right? We as Bitcoiners have devoted ourselves, to varying degrees, but a lot of us, and I think I would argue eventually most of us to basically like every spare moment that we have. It's almost like Bitcoin is, the mining process is capturing that sort of excess energy and turning it into hash rate. The Bitcoin mind virus or meme or that's at the center, the heart of this whole thing that's happening is literally sucking away every like excess brain cycle out of Bitcoiners and turning it to bettering the Bitcoin network, to spreading the good word, to learning more about this and evangelizing.
I was just going to say, I think that's going to be, that's the way I see this all playing out, right? Is this sort of de-evolution of this central state, this central authority, and organizing society from the top down. A return to the idea that, this country, that America was founded upon, which is sort of this weaker central federal government and, local governance in the forms of states, municipalities, counties, et cetera. I see that dissolving back into a more decentralized system. And I think it's going to center around these, centers of energy production, right? And I think what will develop around those is like small sort of, you can call them city states or provinces, whatever, just some kind of like sovereign municipality, self-governing entity. And you can enter in and out of that as a relationship with Bitcoin, right? So like you can, as you enter into that particular district, you can like put X amount of Bitcoin on the blockchain, commit it in a multi-sig address to like, in conjunction with whatever governance body is in that district. And then you live there, that's sort of your buy-in. That's your skin in the game into that place. And you're basically saying, I agree to abide by the, published laws of this district, as long as I'm here and behave by these rules. Then when you're ready to exit that district and move on to somewhere else, you just take that Bitcoin, you go to the next place, you kind of buy into that next district, and you get to move around and sort of shop around for the type of political environment you want to be in, right? The type of society you want to be in. I think at the center of each of those is going to be, this whatever mode of energy production is, you know, best suited to that particular area, and it's going to kind of build out around that. That's going to be kind of the mining locus, the energy locus, and then you'll have these districts of political experimentation that you kind of duck in and duck out of as you wish. But I'm sitting here thinking, and Lynn Arnold is talking also about, like, it depends on your emotional capacity and conviction in the protocol, right? Because it's going to be super volatile, and we all know this, right? We've all spent years developing conviction. I'm sitting here thinking, like,
I was born in the volatility.
I'm relatively over invested in Bitcoin, you know, compared to this advice. But I'm zen as fuck, man. You know?
Yeah, dude.
I'm zen as fuck. It does not bother me at all.
It's totally okay. Like, I don't, like, I see it, and I mean, I get excited when it dips.
Exactly. This is even, you know, this is the next step to skin in the game, right? You buy some Bitcoin to get some skin in the game, but you want to get what Robert Breedlove would call soul in the game.
Yeah,
spend all your time, right? You devote your life, your you know, non-family working life to Bitcoin. And I know there's a lot of people out there that really want to make that happen. And the Bitcoin only industry is, you know, is burgeoning. It's growing. It's this is just the beginning. And, you know, you guys are going to be, you know, ripe for the picking. Bitcoin companies are going to be growing and looking for talent, and they're going to be looking for Bitcoiners. That's what we do at Swan. We look for Bitcoiners. Like, you want to work at Swan, well, you got to be a Bitcoiner first.
Yeah.
And then we look at, you know, your skills and talent in other areas, right? And what we need. But, like, you know, you're not only part of a revolution, but you are building a resume for an industry that is going to explode. So just keep going.
Yeah.
We have this opportunity, you know, and I've been talking about how, you know, this is our time, right? This is our time to shine. We've been waiting for this moment. This is the moment that Bitcoin was built for. It is a real world instantiation of these ideas, the ideas of sound money that, you know, really barely survived. You know, Robert Breedlove on the Swan Signal show this week, you know, talked about how, you know, the ideas of that are behind Austrian economics really came close to just kind of being snuffed out and lost to history. Mises was, you know, kind of the father of the school. You know, he was sent to the front lines of battle. Like, you know, if he hadn't survived and you know, written these books and carried forth these ideas, the light of sound money, the truth of money, who knows what would have happened, right? But now we have this tool, this product, this technology that is the real world version of all of these ideas. And we as Bitcoiners who have, you know, understood, who have done the work to deeply understand what we have here, it is our obligation to share this with the world, to shepherd it to fruition, you know, on a global scale. And I am, you know, just dedicated, excited, and honored to be able to have, you know, realized this at this, like, again, relatively early stage. And, you know, it's, I think people, Bitcoiners out there feel that passion, that dedication, and I see it and I appreciate you. And I'm proud to, you know, be alongside you in this effort to, you know, really bring Bitcoin to the world. Bitcoin is going to change the world. Bitcoin is going to save the world in a lot of ways. It's going to save people, individuals. It's going to improve their lives. You know, I've said this recently on John Vallis's podcast, but it's changed my life. I have become much more cognizant of saving, much more thoughtful about my future. I have, you know, become more disciplined. I've become healthier because I've become more disciplined. Mm-hmm. I've become more productive. I have more self-respect because of all those things. I feel like, you know, and it's, people will be like, well, you know, how does that happen with just like using Bitcoin or having Bitcoin in your life or understanding Bitcoin? Like, how can it do that to you, right? But it's really simply the truth of hard money, right? So we have this incentive, this economic incentive to just think longer term. And from that simple change comes all of these amazing kind of just follow-on you know, influences on your life. And it's that one simple influence creates all these great downstream effects. And then
with the kind of cumulative, you know, effect on all these individuals, will create a society that is, you know, more, the longer, thinks longer term, and, you know, is more thoughtful about the future, engages in longer term projects, is not so focused on consumerism, the short term, you know, planned obsolescence, all that kind of stuff that, you know, is part of fiat culture. So you're listening to this podcast, you are doing something important by learning about Bitcoin, by listening to this podcast, by reading and sharing and educating others. Just holding Bitcoin is an act of defiance against this tyranny of fiat that we're living in right now, this default Keynesian age. So keep it up. You are part of a revolution. You are doing something incredibly important and that you will be extremely proud of later in your life when we're looking back 20, 30 years from now, and we'll just have an amazing sense of satisfaction that we were there at the beginning and we were, you know, doing our part to make this amazing Bitcoin future happen.
Yeah, it seems to be a pretty cool group of people, and just I've learned a ton. And that's the thing that I appreciate the most about people in Bitcoin is this, they're, you know, good thinkers, you know, people who have thought hard and eventually clearly about the world. And I've learned a ton from them and just from studying Bitcoin in general. So
the podcast website is citizenbitcoin.world. Share this one out with your family and friends. Shout me out on Twitter, me and Guy. Let us know what you liked. Share it with your crew on Twitter, the Bitcoiners out there. You know, let them know that you like this, or let me know something that you'd like to see improved, or another guest you'd like to see me get on the show. I'd love to hear from all of you out there. My DMs are open on Twitter. I'm also at Citizen Bitcoin on Telegram. You can find me in both places. Thanks again to Swan Bitcoin for sponsoring this episode, and to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network for including the Citizen Bitcoin in the podcast feed. Check out my merchandise shop at layer1btc.com. Click on partners and then Citizen Bitcoin. There's cool stuff there to check out. And check out the podcast I've created for Swan, the Swan Signal Podcast. It's an audio archive of our weekly Swan Signal Live broadcasts. We have a pair of Bitcoiners on for a compelling discussion. I think it's a unique format in the space and deserves a spot in your rotation. Check it out and see if you agree with me at swansignalpodcast.com. If you have any questions for me, please feel free to reach out. Like I said, my DMs are always open on Twitter, and I'm at Citizen Bitcoin on Telegram. All right, that's it for this week. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.